The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
They would, at the end of every day, give me some sort of insurance policy and make me take it home and read it. And when I got to work in the next day, I would have to respond to their questions about the insurance policy. And if I got the answers wrong, they would dock my pay.
Jeff Liggio shares the tough way he learned insurance law and the four responses he always gives judges in the courtroom.
The judge's eyes got wide and he stood up and he said, "We're in recess." And he walked out of the courtroom.
And the impact the Florida Justice Association has had, not just on his career, but on his life.
That type of relationship goes beyond just the practice of law. If I have a problem in my family, some of the first people that reach out to me are my trial lawyer brethren. And we share each other's disappointments and our successes. And that's more important to us than just the mere practice of law.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Jeff Liggio approaches law practice as a human being first, rather than acting like a lawyer. It's advice he passes along to younger lawyers and is one of his keys to trial success. As you'll learn, he brings honor to an honorable profession. For the first 17 years he was a lawyer, Jeff Liggio was also a military pilot. Given his background, you'd think he would have practiced aviation law. So did he. But it was a determined boss and mentor that steered him instead into insurance law. He's never looked back, building a successful insurance litigation practice over the past 30 years in West Palm Beach. Jeff Liggio sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2020 to talk about the very deliberate approach he brings to cases, the military lessons he takes into the courtroom, and the surprising case that was decided by a verb tense in a contract.
Jeff, unlike most attorneys, you've had not one career, but two, haven't you?
Well, that's correct. I'm actually a night school lawyer. I was a naval officer and a Navy pilot. And, you know, when you're in the Navy, you go to sea duty and then you go to shore duty. And it's usually a 3-year cycle. And I was on due to go to shore duty. And I was looking for a place that I could go on shore duty where I could go to law school at night. And the Navy sent me down to Miami. And I went to night law school at the University of Miami School of Law. When I began practicing law, I transitioned to the Air Force Reserve, and I flew helicopters for the Air Force Reserve until I finally completed my career in the military. So for the first 17 or so years that I was a lawyer, I was also a military pilot for the government and worked with some terrific people and did some terrific work and activity while I was doing so.
Are there some lessons there that helped you in your practice of law?
Yes. And some of the lessons are the most simple lessons. First thing I learned is when I was first a plebe at the Naval Academy, you know, my freshman year, they told us that there are certain required responses when you're talking to a superior. And those responses were, "Aye, aye, sir," which means yes, sir. "No, sir." "No excuse, sir." Or "I'll find out, sir." And any direct question that your supervisor asked you, you could answer with one of those responses. And believe it or not, those very simple, direct responses, when a judge asked me a direct question, have had a major impact on the practice of law. The other thing is that at the age of 17, I took an oath and was working pursuant to that oath. And we had an honor concept. And I have followed that, and my honor has been important throughout my career. I don't lie. I don't shade the truth. You are always better if there's something that's uncomfortable or something you need to address by being truthful and stating in that way. And those have been two of the biggest influences I've had from my military background, those simple lessons. The other thing is I work with terrific people. Got to know people from all walks of life, all income groups, all ethnicities. And the only thing that was important to us in the military was, what kind of job do you do and how do you do your job? And that I've taken those lessons for the rest of my life and in my law career every day.
I'm sure the judges that you appear before appreciate that attitude as well.
Well, I'll tell you one story. There was a judge in Fort Pierce, and he was famous for, well, it was almost like he would create a potential contempt situation with a lawyer. And if he got a little annoyed at a lawyer, he would issue what is called a show cause order to show up in the judge's courtroom like at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and to explain why you shouldn't be held in contempt. And I had a young lawyer working for me, this is years ago, who didn't do anything wrong, but something caused this judge to send a show cause order to her. And she was very upset and concerned that she was going to be held in contempt. So seeing your partner, I said, come on, we're going together. So we went to the courtroom, and the judge walked in and sat in the bench, and he looked at my young lawyer and said, how do you explain yourself? And I put my hand on her shoulder, and I made her stay there, and I said, Judge, I'm Jeff Liggio. I'm the senior partner, and it's my law firm. And if anybody's going to be held in contempt today, you should hold me in contempt. And the judge kind of looked at me, and he said, Mr. Liggio, what do you have? Do you have? Do you explain yourself? And I said, Judge, when I was a plebe at the Naval Academy, I learned those four responses: aye, sir; no, sir; I'll find out, sir; and no excuse, sir. So my response to you, Judge, is no excuse, sir. And if you feel like you need to hold me in contempt, Your Honor, I'm here to take whatever punishment you want to mete out. Well, the judge's eyes got wide, and he stood up, and he said, we're in recess. And he walked out of the courtroom for about 5 minutes, and then he came back in the courtroom, and he had a big old grin in his face, and he said, Mr. Liggio, he said, I get these lawyers in here, and they're all giving me all sorts of excuses, and they're trying to explain stuff. You're the first lawyer that came before me and said, no excuse, Judge. How are you going to punish me? He said, Mr. Liggio, you made my week. Thank you for coming to visit me today. Have a good weekend. True.
There you go.
True. And it was a good lesson for my young lawyer.
A good lesson for everyone listening to this podcast who has anything to do with the practice of law, for that matter. Jeff, you and your firm, which includes your daughter, Olivia, focus mostly on insurance litigation. How did you end up in that line of practice?
Well, there's always a story. The Navy wanted to transfer me before I got done with law school. And likely I would have stayed in the Navy had they extended me for another year. I was working with terrific people and flying magnificent machines, but the Navy wanted to transfer me, so I got out and I got a job clerking at two law firms. Second law firm was a three-person plaintiff's law firm that I started to practice at, when I got my license. Now, you understand, I knew ships, I knew airplanes, I knew helicopters. I had an engineering background from the Naval Academy, and I wanted to be a plane crash lawyer and a maritime lawyer and, you know, a big tort lawyer. The appellate lawyer for my firm was a gentleman named Ed Peirce. He was my mentor, and he was also now retired Justice Fred Lewis's mentor. And Ed Peirce grabbed me and said, you're a smart kid, and I'm the only plaintiff's lawyer that knows insurance law. You're going to learn insurance law. I don't want to learn insurance law. I'm going to be a plane crash lawyer. I'm going to be, a big disaster lawyer.
Right, right.
Well, he convinced my boss, and of course things were different back then, that I was going to learn insurance. So they would, at the end of every day, give me some sort of insurance policy and make me take it home and read it. And when I got to work in the next day, I would have to respond to their questions about the insurance policy. And if I got the answers wrong, they would dock my pay.
Wow.
So I made sure I learned it. And over the years, even after I left that firm and went to West Palm Beach, and by the way, that firm fired me, but went to West Palm Beach, my mentor, Ed Peirce, would direct any insurance disputes my way. And I think of my first appellate opinion dealing with an insurance case was like back in 1985 when I was a three-year lawyer. And as time went on, more and more of the practice became insurance related. We've done some major insurance cases. We've had major victories in the Florida courts and the appellate courts, in the federal courts, in the Florida Supreme Court, that have made good law in the insurance area. We've done class actions in the insurance area, and I owe it all to now long departed Ed Peirce, who made sure that I was smart enough to do insurance work. Mm. That's the story.
That toughness paid off. And as a matter of fact, there's four or five Florida Supreme Court opinions establishing case law that you represented before the court.
And we're very proud of that. We wanted to make sure that when we're done, and we're not done yet, we leave the law in better condition than we found it.
And that's such a consumer-oriented practice, too. Insurance people tend to think is boring, but it's one of those things in life that you just have to have, especially if you want to drive an automobile in the state of Florida. But in addition to that, this case law, you've had some very interesting cases in your career, including one that was won based on the verb tense in an insurance policy. You've got to tell us about that one.
It's a great story. And it's one that, I don't measure myself by the big verdicts or the amount of money we've made, although we've done fine. I measure myself by how we help people. And a few years ago, I had a lady call me up, and she was from Suwannee County, up in the Panhandle. She'd been a public school teacher for 20-some years, so she'd had health insurance through the school system. And she had a health insurance dispute that I'll tell you about that she'd got to some lawyers who claimed they could do insurance work and they couldn't, and they withdrew, and she owed a lot of money for her Medicare. And she called me up from the Panhandle, and she had just a sweet voice. And I told her, something? I don't know if I could win your case, but I'm going to take a look. And what had happened was, back in about 1998, she had weight reduction surgery. She must have been a big girl. And it was successful. And it was covered at the time. She had Blue Cross insurance through the school system. And then about 8 or 9 years later, she began to have some terrible symptoms, terrible problems in her abdominal area. She couldn't hold food down. She would get nauseous. In her classroom, she had to have an extra wastebasket so she could vomit in the wastebasket while she's going on.
Mm.
And she had all sorts of medical care. They thought there was a blockage. They went in and they scoped her. They tried all different things and nothing worked. So finally, in about 2014, about 16 years after she had the procedure, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic outside of Jacksonville found that what was causing her problems was the surgical mesh used in 1998 when they did the surgery. It was problematic. It had to be removed.
Right.
And the procedure was going to be about a $70,000 procedure. That's a lot of money for everybody. It's certainly a lot of money for a public school teacher.
Sure.
Well, by 2014, Blue Cross Shield wouldn't cover weight reduction surgery. And they had language in the 2014 policy that said, we won't cover weight reduction surgery, and we won't cover any complications from weight reduction surgery. And of course, this was a complication of weight reduction surgery that she'd had, but it had taken place 16 years before. Well, insurance policies are drafted in the present perfect, or future perfect tense from high school grammar.
Right.
And we filed a declaratory action, and we were able to convince the judge, who is now in the First District Court of the Appeals, that language meant that if you go outside of what is covered now and you have complications, we're not going to cover it. And it was never intended to cover complications for what had been covered, which is now pre-existing from 16 years before.
Mm.
So the long and the short of it is that very sweet lady got the medical bill paid. We made sure we put some money in her pocket for what she went through. And then the insurance company had to pay our attorney's fees and costs. So, of course, we were able to represent her without paying us at all.
A very important case.
It's something I'm very proud of.
Absolutely. Well, in the 40-some years that you've been practicing insurance law and law, what would you say is your key to success? Is there one particular skill or practice?
We're very deliberate in how we approach a case. We don't shoot from the hip. We understand that every case is going to have a different nuance from the case before. So over the years, I have been very diligent and I've trained my lawyers to be diligent. Read the policy, read the statutes. We go back and read them over and over. Go at it again to make sure we've got it right. And it's that constant reading, that constant questioning, am I doing it right? What have I overlooked? What do I need to do to accomplish what we need to do for the client? What that really is being strategic. When a case first comes in the door, we spend all sorts of time and effort communicating with the client, making sure we have the facts right, making sure we're right on the law. And then we develop a strategy. How are we going to take what we've learned and have a successful outcome for the client? And we're constantly questioning that. But everything we do in a case, everything we react to in a case, is part of our strategy to achieve success for the client. What we notice all the time is our opponents not strategic. Many of them say what they need to say at the moment, never thinking about how that's going to play back later on. They're tactical and they're not strategic, and we're very strategic in every single case.
Hmm. Interesting. How do you find the quality of young lawyers today, either those seeking employment at your firm or those that you observe in the courtroom?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of them, they're book smart, but they're not street smart. They feel they have to talk or act like a lawyer instead of realizing they need to talk and act like a human being. And I'm not saying that our lawyers are like that, because we're careful in who we hire. but you see so much of that in some of the opposing young lawyers. It's really sort of silly. Like I said before, we're direct in how we speak to clients. We're direct in how we speak to opposing counsel. We're direct in how we speak to witnesses. We're direct in how we communicate with judges. And that's what you need to do in life, let alone in the law. And a lot of the young lawyers don't get that. The other thing is, I see a lot of these younger lawyers and who come to us and ask for our help or advice, and a lot of them have not done their homework. They're looking for advice without doing the studying they need to do first. So a lot of the time we spend is really sort of discouraging folks with situations that we can't help them in. And really, they ought to know that. And so I think that's a shortcoming in a lot of these young lawyers. You know, they go to law school, they pass a bar exam, and they think they're ready, but they're not.
Sure. Well, experience is the grand teacher, as they say.
Experience and having the attitude that you need to act like a human being and be a human being first.
How do you handle disappointment?
Well,
because you can't win every case, and not every case is winnable.
No.
Right?
Well, how do you handle disappointment? I mean, this profession is full of disappointment. Any lawyer who thinks she or he is going to win every case and every point, they're wrong. It's just not going to happen. And I deal with disappointment by going back and analyzing, what did I do? What did I do right? What did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? Should I have maybe have not taken the case? Even going back to that point, you know, you don't learn a lesson when you win. You don't learn a lesson when you're congratulated. You learn lessons when you lose. Mm. And so I handle the disappointment by making it a lesson for the next time.
Among your many achievements, Jeff, you are a past president of the Florida Justice Association. You're the winner of its Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award, which pays tribute to an attorney who has pledged their life to upholding consumer rights and fighting for justice. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
It's one of the single most important things I could ever have done. Not because I was a president, not because I won an award, but because of the friends and the associations that I've made through the FJA. It's because of the people that I was able to associate with as I was coming up as a lawyer that I could emulate and I could learn from. And that association was a key to almost everything that I accomplished in the profession. You understand that even my mentor and my first boss in Miami, they were what at that time were Academy of Florida Trial Lawyer members. They were the ones that told me, you now need to be a member of the AFTL and the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers and what used to be ATLA, the American Trial Lawyers Association, that is now the AAJ. I did. I would look forward every month to receiving the new journal. I'd read the magazines. I'd go to the seminars. And you'd go to the seminars, and you may have a case that you have going on, and you'd listen to another lawyer not competing with you, but there to help you. This is what I did. This is what works. This is what didn't work. Mm-hmm. And the associations and the friendships I've made through the Trial Lawyers Organization have been some of the most rewarding ones in my life. I can tell you that I remember, we haven't done it in a while, but for a number of years, John Romano and I, who got me involved in pursuing the chairs and the presidency, we go to breakfast on almost every Saturday morning for a long time. Our dear friend Chris Searcy would join us. And it was just three trial lawyers talking about life, talking about their families, talking about their cases, talking about the system. Through the trial lawyers, we got to know the families. We got to know each other's children. We got to know each other's spouses. And of course, the trial lawyers have an annual retreat in the summertime. And to have lawyers that are moving up in the academy and getting involved, or the FJA and getting involved, to get the families to meet each other is just a wonderful experience. I remember years ago, we had a retreat over in the West Coast. I forget which one of the resorts, West Coast of Florida. And they had all the lawyers and their families in these two condominium buildings. So I got a big golf cart, one of these big 12-passenger golf carts, and I grabbed all the kids. Come on, let's go get an ice cream, you know? That type of relationship goes beyond just the practice of law. If I have a problem in my family, some of the first people that reach out to me are my trial lawyer brethren. Mm. And we share each other's disappointments and our successes. And that's more important to us than just the mere practice of law. I must talk to Ed Zaberski every couple of weeks. I talk to John Romano all the time. Every once in a while, Searcy and I talk about it.
Sure.
Talk. Howard Coker up in Jacksonville, Tony Martino in Tampa. I mean, I can't name all the names, and I don't want to leave anybody out. But, you know, those relationships have been immensely important. And to be involved with the people like that, you know, to spend some time. I remember going out to dinner with Tom Edwards and Howard Coker.
Sure.
At one of the seminars. And, you know, these are people that you at any age want to emulate and be like. These are the kind of people that you want to associate with.
Jeff, how important is it to then give back to the Florida Justice Association, and especially the foundation that focuses on research and education?
Well, we think it's very important. You know, not all trial lawyers are in these big, powerful firms. We have different levels of financial wherewithal and success, but there are certain things that we can do at our particular level to help in the development of the law. We've been lucky in some of us action cases that we've had where there was money that could not be distributed to class members. The defendant had bad records, their addresses had changed, people might have passed away. In one of our larger situations like that, there was over $11 million that was remaining from a class action we couldn't deliver to the class members. So in that case, under the judge's scrutiny, the judge will allow us to make what they call CYPRES, C-Y-P-R-E-S donations. And of that $11 million, we gave, I remember, $1.5 million to the Florida Salvation Army. We gave over $3.5 million to the various legal aid, legal services organizations throughout the state of Florida. And we gave a very substantial donation, and I forget the amount, but it was large, to the FJA's Research and Education Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very proud of it, but also those types of contribution make an impact far beyond your own family and clients and in your own courthouse.
Yeah, you're investing in the future of the profession, which certainly right. faces its challenges. Jeff, how do you balance your professional life with your family life? This is a tough profession, long hours, hard work, complex cases, built-in aggravations. How do you balance the two?
It's a struggle. Even after 38 years of practicing law, it's a struggle. You know, in law school, they teach you the expression that the law is a jealous lover. And the law is. I have a wonderful family. I'm married. It'll be 43 years next month, very shortly next month.
Congratulations.
And my wife is the one that grounds me when it comes to that. And going back to the FJA, I made sure, and I see a lot of lawyers don't do that, but you see a lot of the lawyers like myself, an Ed Zabersky, a John Romano, when they go to an FJA event, they bring their wives, they bring their families. And I recognize how important my family is to my success in the practice of law. Plus, you know, my wife and I have certain routines. I tell a story. When I was 29 years old and I was going to law school at night, I was in shore duty. I was recruiting for the Navy and flying for the Navy and going to law school at night. And our first daughter was a baby, and I was going about 90 hours a week. And I had to go get a flight physical. And of course, to get a flight physical, you got to pass the flight physical to keep your flight pay. So I went to a doctor, and he must have been about my age now, you know, in his 60s. So he looked like, you know, the ancient mariner to a 29-year-old young lieutenant in the Navy.
Right.
And of course, when they give you a flight physical, they want to interview you. They want to talk to you about what's going on in your life to make sure they, before they give you one of Uncle Sam's airplanes and let you fly Uncle Sam's kids, you know.
Sure.
So I remember this doctor was asking about my schedule, and I was working 5 days a week and going to school 5 nights a week. And on the weekends, I was mowing the lawn and trying to take care of the house and trying to be a father and a husband. And so this doctor looks at me and he said, "Do you drink?" And I said, you know, I go out with the guys after school once in a while and have a couple of beers. And the doctor looked at me, he had a real intent inspection in his face, and he said, "I asked you if you drank." Well, I must have looked like a bobblehead doll. I didn't know what he was looking for. I didn't know what to say. And I was concerned, maybe there's something wrong. Maybe I'm going to lose my flight pay, you know.
Right.
But I gave him a variation on a theme. And then he put his finger in my face and called me a name that I'm not going to repeat in the podcast. And he said, "Hey, I asked you if you drank." And I said, "Well, why are you asking me this, doc? Why do you want to know this?" And he looked at me and he said, "You're burning the candle at both ends. You're going about 90 hours a week." And he says, "I'll bet you have some trouble at night trying to fall asleep." I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "If you can control it, I want you to start." Well, I looked at him, a doctor telling me to start drinking? What? You know? I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "If you can control it, I don't care what time you get home, I want you to sit down with your bride and have a glass of wine, a beer, or a cocktail, and talk about your day." I asked him again, "Why are you telling me this?" And he pointed at his jaw, and he said, "Because when that first drop of alcohol comes across your tongue, your body," and he's pointing at his jaw, and then he pointed at the top of his head, "is going to tell your mind it's time to relax." Mm-hmm. Well, I remember going home and calling my wife, Susan. I said, hey, honey, we got a prescription. We got to start drinking. So he followed his advice. And don't misunderstand me. I'm blessed that I don't have the disease. And we've raised 3 kids, and my kids have never in all the years seen their father get inebriated, slur his words, because it literally is one cocktail. But we still have that precious time every day where we sit and have a drink and just talk about how was your day and what's going on this week and have you heard from so-and-so. And I think that's a good part of how Susan and I balance the practice of law in our marriage.
Mm. Sounds like a very smart doctor with sage advice. What about regrets?
Well, I think my biggest regret is when I was coming up in the practice of law and I was still flying for Uncle Sam. And during the last few years when I was still flying for Uncle Sam, I started to get involved in the FJA, my kids were young, and I didn't spend as much time with my three children as I would have liked to as they were growing up. Now I regret that. You know, I did what I had to do, and you know, my kids had the luxury of a stay-at-home mom, but I think my biggest regret is I had those three very big commitments so that I was really on roller skates all the time. And that's my biggest disappointment, I think.
Jeff, how would you like to be remembered?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I'd like to be remembered as an honorable man who helped people who had nowhere else to turn, and who had an impact on the state of the law in his profession. And I was a good husband and a father. And that's how I want to be remembered.
Jeff Liggio, you are a titan of trial. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.